On Alexa powered devices. Download the news skill and then say, Alexa, what's in the news? Dave Mullarkey's up next. Thanks so much for joining us and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Welcome. Nice to have you with us. It's the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Friday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Still no feed in there? Well, we're moving it around here. Nothing. Level check, 1-2, level check, 1-2. Another pot. Okay, good afternoon once again, everyone. Level check, 1-2, level check, 1-2, level check, 1-2, level check, 1-2.
Do you have an Amazon Echo, Tap, or Dot in your home? If you do, you can load the new Butler Radio News skill and get the latest local news, sports, and weather from Alexa anytime you want. The Butler Radio News skill is the area's only skill to offer local news, sports, and weather. To get the skill, open your Alexa app, search for Butler Radio News, and enable the skill. It's that simple. Alexa, what's in the news?
From the Butler Radio Network, here is the latest news.
The Butler Radio Network is proud to be a leader in providing up-to-date local content to you on the devices you use, on your radio, your computer or tablet, your smartphone, and now on your Amazon Alexa device.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood, or an earthquake is destroying buildings. When a tornado is tearing through town, or a hurricane strikes, or is the best time perhaps today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. And it's not always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome to the Friday edition of the It's Your Turn program. And a slight delay there because of a technical difficulty, but I think we're all fine right now, okay? We do our It's Your Turn program from a different studio than our main control room, so I think we've got everything patched in correctly here now. Open talk to begin the program today, 283-2525. We will have guests later on the program. We're going to be talking with Beth Brown, an author who lives in Florida now. She's a Butler native, and she's written a novel that is based in Butler, or at least includes a lot of places from Butler. So I'm anxious to meet her and talk to her. And later on, we're going to be talking about the CIA on the program today. But before we go any further, let's get right to the people here. It's open talk on the Friday program. Caller, thanks for waiting. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Hi.
I have been listening to your program and heard a couple of different people talk to you, with you about the spotter planes and people watching for them during World War II.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, a few days ago, I was cleaning out drawers, and my husband was a World War II veteran, And I found a deck of cards that I just almost bypassed. I thought they were from a Butler firm because the colors were the same.
Mm-hmm.
But I took another look, and the deck says World War II spotter cards.
Wow.
It's a whole deck of cards that were never used, and they're all silhouettes from above, beside, and underneath, and two cards of instructions telling people how to use them. And during this time, you can use them to play your regular games, any bridge or 500 or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it suggests a couple of games so that people would really pay attention to these silhouettes and learn them and be on the lookout for these different planes. But I only looked at a few of them. There's a whole deck of cards. I don't know how often these images are repeated throughout the deck. I really don't know. I didn't examine them that hard, but I was just amazed. I'd never heard of such a thing as these spotter cards for decks of cards at that period of time.
I wasn't aware of them. In fact, this was a couple of weeks ago that we kind of accidentally stumbled onto this Ground Observer program back in the, I thought it was in the 50s and 60s. We had a couple of calls from women who, they said it was in the 40s. One woman called and she said she would go with her older sister, who was one of the volunteer spotters, and she says, I can remember going with her to the little observation hut and watching for planes, and she said it was definitely in the 40s. So, but I have never heard of somebody that still had one of the identifying pictures or the group of identifying pictures.
It's on a deck of cards, a regular deck of cards.
Wow. How about that?
That was very curious.
Now, did you say those were in your husband's belongings?
Yes. They are. They were. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. I had to be looking for something of his, and I was looking through a drawer, and I said, oh, there's another deck of cards, because we have quite a few, but these were different for sure.
Well, the ground observation spotter hut that I was aware of was between Foxburg and St. Petersburg, high on a hill above the Allegheny River, but we had several calls from people who were in different locations, so apparently these were all over the place.
I guess so.
Yeah. Boy, a different era, huh? Thank goodness
we don't have to live
through that today. Wow.
No, I thought it was interesting, though, to find these cards right after you talked about it on the radio.
I couldn't believe how many calls we had from people who either did it or family members did it, or it just astonished me.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, thanks for calling. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah. All right, then.
Nice to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good to listen to your program.
Oh, thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Open talk on the It's Your Turn program today. Yesterday we were talking about the release of the JFK files, if you were with us yesterday, and I was wondering, where are they? Because I was very anxious to find out, if there was anything in there, was any bombshells or anything. And I kept looking at the various news wires while we were on the air yesterday. I couldn't find it. I said, what the heck? How come they haven't been released yet? Well, you heard the story, of course. They weren't released until about 7:30 last night. Very, very bizarre. And not all of them were released. There were some 3,000 files that were scheduled to be made public, to be released from the National Archives, and only about 2,800 of them were released. About 200 were kept back. And there was a memo from President Trump who blocked the release of the approximately 200 files at the request of the CIA and the FBI. Well, the other files were, in fact, released. Don't people realize that all this does is make people more suspicious? Certainly makes me more suspicious. What the heck are they hiding? This has been what a lot of people have been asking for 50 years. And I was watching the news last night on TV, thinking that surely I'm going to get some word about this. Finally, at 7:30, release of the files, except 200 of them are being withheld. And, right away, you say, what the heck is going on here? For goodness sakes, they had 25 years. Congress passed a law 25 years ago that these files would be released yesterday. All of them, by the way. That's the law. That was the law that was passed. All remaining files relating to the JFK assassination will be released. 25 years ago, they passed that law. And the day they were supposed to be released, that's when the CIA and the FBI said, whoa, wait a minute, you're rushing the process. That was literally one of the reports this morning on CBS Radio here on WISR. CIA officials claimed that the president was rushing the process. Rushing the process. 25 years they had to go through these things and see if there was anything in there. And now they said, well, we want to redact some stuff. In other words, we want to black out some stuff, yada, yada, yada. Surely, what? They're worried that there was evidence of a Soviet connection to the assassination. That's the first thing that I think of. Folks, it was more than 50 years ago. It was 54 years ago, actually, right? Next month, 1963. Today, we have Russians who are buying advertisements on Facebook and Twitter to affect our presidential election. And we're worried about revealing something from 54 years ago about, it wasn't even the Russians then, it was the Soviet Union. That's insane. It's insane. Is there something in there that's going to make the CIA look bad? That's another speculation that came out today. What are they hiding? Maybe the CIA should have done more. There were two reports on CBS Radio today as people continue to sift through the 2,800 files that were released. Very interesting. There was a call about 25 minutes before Kennedy was shot. About 25 minutes before Kennedy was shot, there was a call to British media in the UK to call the embassy that there was going to be big news about the President of the United States. Very suspicious. And then later, after the assassination, a day later, there was a call to the FBI that said something could happen to Oswald. Should the FBI have been more alert? Should they have blocked the idea of Oswald being... If you've seen the video, it was all over TV last night, how they marched him through the police station in Dallas. Had deputies on either side holding him. Big photo opportunity, big perp walk. And Jack Ruby walks up and shoots him in the stomach. And he dies a short time later. Could that have been prevented? One would think. It also turns out from the papers that were released yesterday, we knew that Oswald had been in Mexico just a week or two before the assassination. Turns out he was trying to meet with Cuban spies, and he was trying to meet with Soviet spies down there. Once again, you wonder about the CIA. Should they have been more aware of this guy? Should they have been tracking him? I don't know. It just raises questions like crazy. I'll tell you what we're going to do. When I heard about this, I was shaking my head. I couldn't believe it. 25 years, and the day that the papers are going to be released, the CIA said, wait a minute, you're rushing it here. We may want to black out some of this stuff. We're going later on the program today, around 1:30. We are going into the It's Your Turn archives because a year or so ago, I was able to do an interview about the CIA. About the CIA and the rise of America's secret government. I thought it would be fascinating. I have not listened to it yet. We're going to listen to it on the final segment of the program today, talking with writer David Talbot about Alan Dulles and the rise of America's secret government, the CIA. Well, in light of what's happened in the last 24 hours, I think that might be kind of interesting. I was hoping that we still had the program in our files, the interview, and we do. So we'll get to listen to that a little bit later on the program today. Call to the FBI. Something could happen to Oswald. Better watch out. Call to British news media half an hour before Kennedy was shot. Big news. Call the embassy. Big news coming about the president. Just all sorts of questions. All sorts of questions. Will we ever get the answer now? I don't know. What's in the 200 files that the CIA and the FBI do not want released yet? They want 6 more months to go through them. So that's what Trump said yesterday. Well, we're going to release them in, it was April, I think, 6 months. Yeah, is that April? We're going to release them in 6 months, going to have a chance to go through them. It's been 25 years, for goodness sakes. It's insanity. Who can believe any of this? Don't they realize that this is just going to do nothing more than fuel more conspiracy theories? Should have released the whole ball of wax. Let the chips fall where they may. It was 54 years ago. All the principals involved are dead. What's it matter? And beyond just curiosity, incidentally, don't you think the American people have the right to know? And if they had some reason for withholding the information 54 years ago, okay, we'll find out what it was. Maybe it was legitimate. Let's talk about it. But for goodness sakes, let's make it public. What are we waiting for? We're going to wait 500 years? Going to wait for Amazon to deliver it to our door for us by drone? I just find it incredibly fascinating and incredibly sad, you know. Whether you liked the JFK or not, I had a lot of problems with some of his policies. I appreciated some of his other stuff as I look back on it and read about it. But I certainly didn't find him as any demigod, but by the same token, nobody deserves to be assassinated just because somebody disagrees with what they're doing as president. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. I haven't really had a lot of feedback on this yet, because it wasn't the last night that we got the word about what happened to this. How come they're not being released? What's going on? So I imagine that there'll be more news tonight on some of the national news networks and the cable news networks. They'll probably have some of the authors who have written about the Kennedy assassination on. I wouldn't be surprised if Dr. Wecht is on one of the networks tonight, Dr. Cyril Wecht. We're going to try to get him on. He's involved in a conference, or he's about to be involved in a conference out west somewhere on the Kennedy assassination. When he gets done with that and gets back to Pittsburgh, we'll try to get him on with us. We've had him on several times in the past. In fact, we had him on one time talking exclusively about the assassination and his investigation into it. So we'll look forward to that. But I just shake my head at the federal government last night. I said, well, you're rushing it. We need a little more time. 25 years. Are you people nuts? What, do you think we're idiots? 283-2525, open talk. Let's get back to the people here today. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Dave, this is the sister that it used to go with the older sister on spotting the planes.
Oh, yes. Hey, I was talking about you a few minutes ago.
Yes, and my daughter got a write-up on everything, so I thought if you're interested, I would either drop it off at the station or mail it to you.
Either one. I would love to have it, and I promise I'll get it back to you.
Well, you don't have to get it back to me.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You can keep it, and I thought I'd give you word ahead of time to be looking for it, okay?
Oh, absolutely. Did you hear the caller that found a deck of spotter cards in some of her husband's memorabilia?
Yes, I did. That's very interesting.
Now, when you were with your sister, I know you were just a little girl, but do you have any memory? Did she have I thought you told me she had a book or something that she would look in.
Yeah, there was a kind of a booklet that she had.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But it just had pictures of planes that
yes,
so she could identify what it was. Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
So I'll get this to you one way or another, okay?
Oh, that would be terrific. Thanks for thinking of me. One more question. Can you hang on yet?
Yeah.
Can you tell me approximately where this spotter station was that you would go to with your sister?
Well, you would go out 38.
Okay.
And where the water works, the American Water Company is on the left-hand side.
Mm-hmm, right.
Across the road, there was, across the 38, there was a smaller road that went up a little hill. And we went up there quite a ways, and it was quite tall. And I know for years we would go up there just to see if there was anything left of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And there were pieces left. Mm-hmm. But the last time we were there were quite a few years ago, and you could see places where it was constructed, but there wasn't really anything there.
I have been up that road. I think that's the road that eventually takes you to the Thorn Run Dam when you get back in there a little further.
Yeah, possibly.
But you're correct. It goes up quite a hill, and of course, they wanted these observation huts, these spotter places. They wanted them on a hill, you know,
that's
for
right,
that's better
right.
visibility.
And we would always be assigned the same one.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thanks so much for thinking of me, and if you do get a chance to either mail that or drop it off, I would love you for it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 283-2525. I can't remember how we got started talking about this. It may have been because I saw a story on the wire that people in Hawaii, this is kind of sobering, but people in Hawaii were stocking water and supplies just in case there's an attack from North Korea, because, you know, North Korea now has these advanced missiles. Can't get to the U.S. mainland yet, but they can get to Hawaii. And they're not making any big deal about it. They don't want to start a panic, but there are people that are they're making plans. I don't think they're building air raid shelters, but they're making plans. That may be how we got started. I'm not sure. But anyway, I learned a lot more about these Ground Observation Corps, was what it was called. And they were, to the best of my knowledge, all volunteers. Nobody was getting paid. But they would go so many hours a certain day of the week to these spotter huts, a pair of binoculars and identifying pictures. And if they heard or saw planes, they would identify them and write them down. Turn it in. Turn in the info. It sounds primitive. Because today, you know, we've got radar and the dew line and everything else, but back then we didn't have any of that stuff. And I was actually in one of those huts. I was a little kid. I wouldn't even be able to guess how old I was. 5, 6, maybe, I don't know. But the memory of it is quite vivid. I was with my dad. We were getting a Christmas tree at the what was referred to commonly as the Legion Farm, up by St. Petersburg, high on a hill, of course. And there was one of those huts up there. Okay, back to the people we go, 283-2525. Hi, caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead, it's your turn.
Hi. My mother used to say that she was a spotter, but actually she wasn't. She worked as a volunteer during the war in a secret office.
Huh.
In Harrisburg, it was back an alley off the square in Harrisburg. And she was in the office where they plotted all of the information that came in from the spotters.
Wow.
I know you've seen on movies a glass map, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people writing on them with chalk.
I've seen that, yeah.
And that's what she did.
Wow.
But she would never say where she worked. She didn't say exactly what she did. And even after the war was over and they disbanded all this, she would never even tell us where that office was, other than I know it was back one of the alleys off the square in Harrisburg.
Wow. Now, was she from that area? Is that why she was working there?
But all of those spotters called in your information to these places where they plotted everything.
Wow. Did you ever get to talk to your mom? Were you old enough? Were you able to talk to her about this when you were an adult, or were you a little kid?
She really wouldn't talk much about it. And as I say, she said she was a spotter, which she wasn't.
Well, she was an important part of the whole mechanism, though, wasn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know exactly what she did. I don't know if she accepted the phone calls, if she was marking things on the map, that glass wall-like. I don't know what she did.
Do you, one final question here, do you have any idea even roughly when this would have been? Was it in the 40s or the 50s, do you know?
Oh, it was in the 40s. It was during World War II.
During the war, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was in junior high and high school at the time.
Well, gosh, thanks for taking the time to call in and share the information with us. We're learning more and more about this, and it's truly amazing to look back about how, you know, compared to today, you know, we're at war today in Afghanistan. But
yeah.
Unless you have a family member or a friend over there, you know, our life goes on as usual. We don't even think about it.
Yeah, pretty much.
A whole lot different in World War II. Everybody was involved one way or another, weren't they?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
if not with something like this, you were making balls of tin foil and
rationing
saving papers, and people had victory gardens, and so everybody was involved in some way or other.
Yep. Hey, so nice to talk with you today. Thanks so much for calling.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. 283-2525 is our number. Caller, boy, thanks for your patience. I know you've been waiting a while. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
I graduated from high school in 1956. And my first job was at the phone company. And one of the things we did when we worked there, I was a what they called a pole operator. And all the long-distance calls got transferred over to Bell. And the calls would come in, and they would say, Conrad Alert.
Oh, wow.
And we immediately send it to a certain place. I don't remember. This is back when you still had the plugs where you stuck the plugs in.
Like in a switchboard.
You immediately had to do it. You couldn't hesitate. You know, whatever.
Wow.
And the other thing is up on the top of Center Avenue, where the new sheets, and there was a building, and it was kind of like a little square white, and it seems to me it had Conrad Alert on it somewhere. And that's where, you know, and it had windows all around, and that's where somebody used to sit and spot.
Well, the
that would have been somewhere between 50 and 56, I think.
Well, the one that I remember was definitely not in the 40s. I guarantee you that, because I wasn't around.
But this was still part of the Cold War,
I
think. I mean, the war was over. I mean, the war was over in 45.
But that's the way I remember this hot tub. It wasn't very big, and it had...
big enough to turn around in it.
And all four walls were glass.
Glass
windows. Yeah.
Those phone calls were probably going to a destination very similar to the previous caller was talking about that her sister did. When they come in and somebody would spot something, and like, you know, I was always interested in it, and I would like to have done it, but I think I was too young. And by the time I got old enough, then they were, like, phased out.
Well, the people that lived through that Cold War as adults, I was a kid, so I, you know, kids don't know about it. They don't worry about it. But, man, the adults during the height of the Cold War, what a worry that must have been, huh?
Well, it really wasn't much worse than it was during the war years. I mean, it was every bit as bad during the war years, except you weren't as worried about a plane coming overhead and bombing your house. But those are things that I think I was 7 when the war was over. But those are things you used to think about and talk about among yourselves, you know, among the kids. You know, you'd hear a little bit here and a little bit there.
Yeah.
And there was no television, no TV, and newspapers. And if you didn't take the time to either look at or read a newspaper, you didn't, know except what your adult told you.
Hey, thanks for calling today. It was great to talk to you.
Okay.
Thanks
bye.
Thanks much. 283-2525. We have time for one more call. Caller, you're going to have the last word today. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Dave, I'm from Beaver County.
Mm-hmm.
Those towers that you're talking about were on most of the higher elevations. In fact, man, it was one in our back of our high school, and they actually recruited high school students, the older ones. And I worked on one of those for 2 years.
Wow.
And, of course, where we were was right in the flight path of Greater Pittsburgh Airport.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they were all around. Any place you had a large mill or anything of that nature, they were probably located nearby at some function like that.
Were you strictly a volunteer, or did the government?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't pay anything, huh?
Nope.
Wow. Well,
you did it after school. For us, we did it after school till about 9, 10 o'clock.
That's what I heard from the other people. I can't believe the number of people that have called into the program and, either done this or had a connection to the family members who did it, and everybody was a volunteer. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they were just little gray sheds set up on four legs, and you could get three people in there, two telephones and binoculars, and you watched.
Hmm.
And you got pretty good at identifying all those aircraft.
One final question. The one that I was in when I was a little kid, excuse me, and my memory on this is pretty solid. It had some sort of like a parabola microphone or something on the roof with a speaker inside so that it amplified the sound of planes flying over.
We had nothing like that. Ours was primarily seeing the aircraft in the air.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, nice to talk to you today, my friend. Thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
We take a break. Our first guest joins us. She's here in the studio, or will be here in the studio with us. She is Beth Brown. I'm anxious to meet her, and we will do so here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Whether you're a competitive athlete or a weekend warrior, any injury that keeps you on the sidelines is not one worth having. The sports medicine specialist at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers will help you get back into action so you can keep up your lifestyle. Our experts understand that the same treatments for competitive athletes can be used for those who just want to be able to stay active. They accept major insurance plans, including both Highmark and UPMC. Learn more about how you can get back on the field by visiting TriRiversMSK.com.
Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
At Butler Health System, there's more to medicine than the most advanced tools and techniques. There's the dedication to providing the most personal care, one that's shared by every member of our team, like renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Horowitz.
I came to Butler because I wanted to practice medicine the way it's supposed to be done. It's truly about the patient. We get to know the people and what's important to them.
That dedication is why Butler Health System is trusted by our neighbors across the region and chosen by exceptional doctors who share our philosophy that the patient comes first, like orthopedic surgeon Charles Spingola.
I knew I'd have the tools and technology, but I also knew that there was a real commitment to genuine care. We don't treat medicine like an assembly line.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care, but more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Good friends, nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program on a Friday. It's always nice on a Friday, huh? Especially Friday afternoon. I like it. I have been looking forward to meeting our guest for, oh gosh, a couple of weeks now since I found out that Beth Brown was coming back to her hometown to hold a book signing about a novel that she's written that includes many, many references to Butler. And she's here to talk about it with us. First of all, Beth Brown, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
We talked on the telephone, and you know how, I don't know, because I talk to people on the telephone a lot. I can tell within about 30 seconds whether I've got a rapport with somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I knew you and I had a rapport. We ended up talking for 15 or 20 minutes, I think.
I had a great time. Yeah.
All we were doing was setting the date whenever we could get together. Your book is on sale at the Book Nook, downtown Butler.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And yes. That's where you're going to be making your book signing.
Yep.
That's tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. From 11 to 1.
Okay. Will you be signing copies of books if people buy it?
Yes, I will, definitely. And it's a reduced price from what you pay on, let's say, Amazon. Mm-hmm. So the books at the book signing are $10.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Very good. The title of your book, it's a novel.
Right? It is.
Is Threaded Destiny.
Threaded Destiny, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch? Obviously, we're not going to reveal the whole thing, but can you give us a little sketch of what it's about?
Well, you know, I like to bring up a visual. Imagine you're about to start high school in a new town.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been moving around every year for literally as long as you can remember. And then, boom, your grandmother says to you, you're right back where you started. You are now living in the town where you were born, and you're here to find out more about the parents you can't even remember. So
there's some time travel-like stuff involved here?
Well, you know, there is. It is a light sci-fi, I call it. And Threads is actually a term that comes from computer science. When there's a program that goes off into like 10 different directions and then comes together in the end with results. And you can think of threads as being different timelines in the universe. But in the end, they all sort of come together for your main life, let's call it.
Now, listeners, how do you think our guest would know something like this about the threads being a part of a computer science? Because she's an engineer and you've taught computer science for several years in your new home state of Florida, right?
Yes. I started and I graduated from Butler High, and then I went to BC3, went through the metrology program. Great experience, great teachers, really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. Worked actually in research development for a couple years, and that influenced the book as well. Because there's a lab that's involved in part of the storytelling. And then when I got to Florida, I got my BS in computer science and taught. And actually, I taught high school and college students, but I wrote more than 40 computer science textbooks.
Wow.
So that's where I really did a lot of writing.
So even years ago, there were high school students in Florida taking computer science?
Yes.
Or as we used to say when I was an undergraduate school, comp sci.
Comp sci, yes.
Really?
Yep, a lot of programming. And
and you've taught at the college level too?
Yes, I have, yes. Uh-huh. And currently I work at Palm Beach State College in the tutoring center. I'm a learning specialist.
Okay, so you're on the east coast of Florida then, Palm Beach.
Yes, huh? Palm Beach County, yes. Delray Beach, just between West Palm and Fort Lauderdale.
Mm. You know, I've only been to Florida once in my life, which is probably most books. Is that possible? Did you ever go to Disney World or anything? No. Actually, I went to the Orange Bowl once.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it was a crazy trip. A bunch of fraternity brothers decided, we're going to the Orange Bowl. We're driving. We must have been crazy because we didn't have that much time between fall term and next semester. We did, so I know those towns. We dribbled down through all of those.
Yeah.
West Palm and Lauderdale and Hollywood. And
You really made it all the way down.
Eventually to Miami. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's another story for another day. So you've lived in Florida then for some time, several years.
About 29 years. Yes.
Do you ever get back to Butler? You still have family here?
Oh, I come back at least once a year. Mm-hmm. And my sister's here, and my sister-in-law, my husband is a Butler native, Chris Brown.
Oh.
Yeah, and he has family here too, so we come back every year to visit.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
When I was talking with Beth Brown on the phone, I guess we finally hooked up a week or so ago. I don't remember exactly when it was. And she said, I can't wait to see the fall color. And I said, well, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings. I said, we don't have much fall color this year. Everything was either dull brown, terracotta, or still green. But lo and behold, I'm serious. You can ask your sister. In the last 3 or 4 days, we've suddenly had a little burst of color.
Well,
but you can see there's still hundreds of trees that have leaves on.
I know. It's surprising.
It's been a very,
for
very
so
strange
late in the year.
Autumn. Very
yeah.
strange autumn.
Yeah.
Well, at least I'm glad you get to see some color when you're back here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how does a computer science major, teacher of computer science, engineer, how does she decide she wants to write a novel? Had this been a secret dream for all of your life? Or?
You know, even at Butler High, I really loved to write.
Really?
And I had to make the choice between the AP English class and all the little computer programming classes, and I actually chose the programming. And but when I got to college, not in metrology, but when at Florida Atlantic University, I found a ad for a part-time job at a publisher, for a publishing company in mm-hmm. Boca. So I just loved it because I could apply my knowledge to writing textbooks. And but I always had this seed of an idea to write a novel. And just a few years ago, I came across this book called The Natural Philosophy of Time, and I was reading it, and it just sort of, all these ideas kind of conjured themselves into my mind, and that was that. I had to write the book.
Well, the hook, the real interest for us is that there are a lot of references.
Absolutely.
To Butler. In fact, they're everywhere in your book. Now, have you actually set it in a named town, or is it just kind of nebulous?
The town's name is Harper, but it is absolutely modeled after downtown Butler. And a lot of historical historical information related to Butler. My grandmother, my mother, my sisters and I all went to the Yellow Brick, you know, at one point in our lives for school. And my mother's experience was that they did walk downtown for lunch. So I incorporated that because I just thought that sounded just like so much fun, you know, how great to be in high school and to walk downtown and eat lunch at the hot dog shop or Woolworths or, you know, Cummings Candy, wherever.
You know, the Yellow Brick is not there anymore.
I know. All the more reason to put it in the book, I thought.
Anybody that's from Butler will know right away that you're a Butlerite when you refer to a school as just the Yellow Brick.
Yellow Brick, yes,
so true. No other modifiers needed. No, it's just the Yellow Brick. Oh, yeah, the old school, because there was a Red Brick building right beside it.
Yes.
And to differentiate, one was the Yellow Brick, one. Red Brick's still there, by the way.
Yes.
Totally modified.
Well, my nephew's there.
Oh,
so,
well, so
yeah.
you know what it's all about. It's all modernized and everything, and it's now a middle school.
Yeah. I've heard.
So
I know.
It's been repurposed all over the place. But all that's left of the footprint of the Yellow Brick is a parking lot and a playground. Now, you changed some of the names.
For example,
the hot dog shop. Anybody from Butler will know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes.
But you call it the Hots. The Hots.
Yeah, just Hots. Yes. Yeah. And Woolworths became Hubbles, and Cummings became Matter Drinks.
So they still have a red and white awning like
it
Cummings does.
It does, absolutely. I think anyone who knows Butler can recognize the landmarks.
Did you, because I've never written a novel, do you have to change names like that for legal purposes, for liability purposes, or did you just do it because you wanted to?
I think a little of both. I don't really think there would be any consequences with using the name, but I wanted to create a fictionalized town that was relatable, and I really enjoyed growing up in Butler, so I just thought it would be fun to look at the historical information and get that in there.
I'm not sure whether people are as worried about that as they used to be. And I was watching a movie on TCM a couple of weeks ago. It's my favorite TV channel, Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
And this was an old black and white from the 30s or something. I had these big warnings before and after the movie. All characters in this film are strictly fictional, and any relation, direct or indirect, to a person living or dead is absolutely an accident. I mean, I must have been really worried about being sued back in the day.
Well, that's still a disclaimer that that authors really do need to put into the front of their books.
Mm-hmm.
So
you have some, but it's one thing to have places that are easily recognizable to, she's not fooling anybody, the Hots, right? but it's a little bit different when you're talking about characters. Now, did you include any real people?
No, I really didn't. Okay. My characters are, personality traits from many different people and walks of lives, but I haven't, nobody is modeled after anybody in particular.
Your main character, your narrator, your protagonist is Ellis?
Yes, Ellis Bell.
Who's Ellis?
She's really not modeled after anybody. She's a blend of 14-year-old girls and their wishes and their worries and their hopes and dreams, I guess.
Can I read a sentence from the, I think this is from the back cover of your book. Ellis thought her, folks, how's this for a hook? Ellis thought her parents had died in an accident 10 years ago. When she learns that they disappeared on an unknown timeline and can't find their way back, Ellis forces herself to try to look for them. So
yes,
that's the nugget of your story.
She's a shy girl, but she slowly realizes she can't continue that way if she really wants to forge her own path, to choose her own destiny.
Now, is she a teenager at the time, or is she now in her mid-20s? What's the 10-year reference?
Her parents have been out of her life since she was 4.
Oh, okay.
She's 14.
So she's still in her mid-teen.
Yeah.
Early teens, actually.
Early teens, yeah, just starting high school.
So what mystifies me a little bit is the fact that, if her parents had disappeared on a dark and stormy night, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, then I could say, okay, her parents disappeared on an unknown timeline.
Yes.
That's kind of spooky. Kind of
yes.
Spooky there, Beth.
Well, they're research scientists, and they developed something that did more than they expected, and it allowed them to travel to different timelines. So a parallel universe in a way.
So they worked in a lab?
They did.
And they come up with a time machine or something like that?
Yes, and it's a glass. It's a lab that researches glass. And that's where they were. And you could say that was definitely influenced from Preston Labs out in Meridian.
I was going to say, there's one of the, we have a glass laboratory
yes.
on the outskirts
oh,
of Butler.
Absolutely. And yeah. That little seed of an idea, I think, was planted when I was about 14.
I was going to say, how could you remember that? Dr. Frank Preston and his wife, Jane, started the company that, it's now AGR,
right.
American Glass Research, but it was Preston Labs. And you may not have caught up with this information, maybe you have. Dr. Preston, of course, died decades ago. His widow lived for many, many years. She died, I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was so recently.
Left the whole estate to Butler Township, provided that it be turned into a park. And that's what it is.
My friend, who I used to go exploring the woods with out in Meridian, and that's when we discovered Preston Labs. We didn't know what it was called then, and we just had all these ideas, and our imaginations went wild trying to figure out what is this place in the middle of the woods.
So I'm becoming more and more intrigued now.
Yes.
So the parents of young Ellis were research scientists. They worked in researching glass and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they accidentally got on this, they got on the wrong timeline or something?
They did. They developed glass for solar panels that was extremely efficient at converting solar energy to electricity. But during the testing phase, they discovered it had other properties. And it took some time for them to figure out what was going on, but they learned that they could travel to different timelines with this glass. Mm. Yeah.
And so they woke up, and instead of being in Meridian, they were in Hickey Bottom or something like that?
It doesn't happen quite like that, but I don't want to give it away.
Anything else that you can tease us with? As we said, we're not giving away the whole book. That's the fun of reading a book.
Well, what I like about the book is just her daily life. And what I think is interesting for people, would be interesting to people in this area, is all the little references, right down to kiffles. I don't know if you know what a kiffle is, but my husband's still looking for a kiffle. He used to go to Kashuk's Bakery to get those. And
it's a seasonal bakery,
yeah,
item,
I don't even know.
A holiday or something?
Yes. And there's a little bit of Pennsylvania Dutch language mixed in there. My husband's Pennsylvania Dutch, and his grandmother spoke German. So there's that influence. But I think what I like the most about it is that she's living with her grandmother and developing a relationship with a new best friend and just learning about herself and how to be more confident in the path that she needs to take.
Is there any of Beth at all in young Alice?
Well, she's interested in science, so that's definitely...
Which you were from an early age.
Oh, very early, yes. Always loved science. Always loved doing experiments and learning about science. And
many times when I talk to an author and they'll deny... that, you know, for example, oh, there's nothing of me in that character. I always kind of chuckle because don't most people write about what they know, really?
Exactly.
You know?
Yes.
You had to experience some of these things to write about it.
I mean, I had to do a lot of research, so I didn't know everything that's now in the book, but the feelings and the actions, I mean, that has to come from somewhere. So I think it's from experiences.
Do you date this in any certain period in the future, Beth?
No, I really don't. And I don't really get into, oh, she had her cell phone or she didn't. I mean, I try to make it something that could take place at any time. Not too far in the past, but, you know, current time.
So you're wanting the reader to use their imagination a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah.
Best kind of book.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. To me, it is. That's why it's so many times disappointing when you read a good book and then a couple of years later you see the movie and you say, well, I didn't picture her as anything like that.
Exactly.
In my mind's eye.
The books are always better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
With one exception in life.
Mm.
The Godfather.
The Godfather. Yeah. Okay.
The movies were better than Mario Puzo. Although, I think he helped write the screenplay, if not... most of the screenplay.
I'll have to say I've only ever seen the movies. I actually didn't read those books.
Well, I read the books and I saw the movies. And
the movies were pretty
rare,
good, huh?
It's a rare case. Yeah. The movies were better. We're talking, listeners, if some people are joining us midstream here, and that happens a lot, especially with people listening to radio in a car. Beth Brown is with us. Beth is a Butler native. Went to Butler High School. Graduated from Butler High School. Went to BC3. And went on, she became an adult and became an engineer, teacher of computer science down in Florida. She's lived in Florida for 29 years
mm-hmm.
now. But still family in Butler, and obviously, as you can tell from listening to her, still a very warm spot in her heart for the Butler area. So she's back a lot to visit family once a year, something
yes,
like that.
Yes, once or twice.
Mm-hmm. And she's written a novel called Threaded Destiny with tons of references about the Butler area, mostly the city of Butler, I guess, right?
Yes.
Most of your references?
Mostly downtown, yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a break. We'll talk more with Beth. She'll be with us for a little while yet. I got more questions for her, after all. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Don't forget, a little bit later on the program, we are going into the It's Your Turn archives today. And I don't know, I thought this was a good idea. I hope it is. You know, with the news yesterday that the remaining files, some 3,000 files on the assassination of John F. Kennedy, were to be released yesterday. Congress passed a law 25 years ago, said they will be released on that date yesterday. And we were here on the program. We said, well, I'm checking all the wire stories. There's nothing. They weren't released until last night at 7:30, and they weren't all released because the CIA and the FBI said, well, you're rushing this. We want to go over some of this stuff and edit some stuff out. 25 years they've known that yesterday was the date. And on the very day, hang on a second. It makes me very suspicious. I've been suspicious about this investigation from the very beginning. There's something that isn't quite right about this. I don't know whether we'll ever know. But anyway, the CIA, America's secret government. And I remember that I'd had the opportunity to do an interview a year ago, I think, maybe a year and a half, with David Talbot, about the founding of the CIA and the rise of America's secret government. So we're going to take another listen to that interview on the final segment of our program today. I don't know whether it'll shed any light on the current controversy. Didn't they realize that by holding 200 files back, all that was going to do was fuel all of the conspiracy theories all over again? Yeah.
Exactly.
Quick break, and then we talk more with Beth. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler. Gone Postal Butler, it's your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Do you ever have to send a package, or especially if you got three or four? And, you know, where's the paper? Where's that special tape that you need? Where, Ethel, do we have any of those mailing labels left? It is such a bag. At Gone Postal Butler, they package your items for shipping. How about that? Convenient or what? And by the way, you can ship them any way you want. That's up to you. FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service. They do it all for you. Yeah. They are located just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande Restaurant in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. I'll give you a phone number in a second. You can give them a call and find out about many of their other services. In addition to packaging items for shipping, they also have copying service, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, if you need that for a while. They have custom boxes, greeting cards. There's even an official notary there. Sometimes you need something notarized before it goes out. Sounds pretty neat, huh? Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Phone number is 724-841-0044. Newcastle Road, right behind the King's and Villa Grande restaurant. Gone Postal Butler. We'll be back to talk more with Beth Brown right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Since 1938, Hunter Truck Sales has been a leader in the trucking industry. With 19 locations, we've grown to be the largest heavy truck dealership network in the Northeast. Proudly, Hunter has employed generations of families in the region and was recently honored to be named 2017 Family Business of the Year by the Pittsburgh Business Times. Check it out online at huntertrucksales.com for truck inventory, careers, and locations. Across our network, Hunter will provide solutions for all your trucking needs.
Back, good friends. We're chatting with Beth Brown. Delightful to have her with us. Delightful to have her back in Butler from her home in Florida. She's here because she'll be signing copies of her novel, Threaded Destiny, tomorrow at the Book Nook on Main Street downtown.
Yes, from 11 to 1.
Mm-hmm. And if you purchase a copy, I'm sure she'll be happy to sign it for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
You can say hello to her and talk to her a little bit. During the break, I asked Beth if she had any more books, you know, in the pipeline. Why would I ask a question like this of a computer scientist? You're working on a couple of novels, but you're doing textbooks, too? You're writing some kind of computer science for Microsoft or what?
For Microsoft Office, a series of books. It's called the N90 Pages series. They're each 90 pages long. One is about Word, one is about Microsoft Excel, and the other's about PowerPoint. And the two are already out and doing very well. I think there's a lot of people that want to cut the fluff and get straight to the stuff. If you want to learn how to format a document, you don't want to have to read through six paragraphs of, you know, blah, blah, blah. You want the steps written out for you to follow, and that's the basis of these books, step-by-step information.
Have you ever seen, I've picked them up, you know. I want to learn a little bit more about PowerPoint. You pick it up, it's like the old Sears Roebuck Christmas catalog.
Exactly.
You know? Weighs 10 pounds. Who wants to wade through all of that?
Yes, exactly. It's always been my mission to help people, not to, you know, give them more stuff to muddle through.
See, I have to confess, mathematics, anything mathematics, was never my forte. I was just, I mean, I struggled through. I did okay, you know, but it was not fun for me. I mean, it was tough. Language arts, that's no problem. That's a totally different ballgame. But I have great admiration for somebody who can be cranking out two or three of these books at a time. It's amazing.
It's such a pleasure. I honestly feel such joy when I'm able to sit down and write.
Do you, if you don't mind, if I can ask, say, specifically when you're working on a novel, do you set aside a certain number of hours a day? Do you get up and write at the same time every morning? Or?
Well, that's difficult. I raised two kids. They're both adults now. One's in college and one is working. And so I would just kind of have to squeeze it in. I would say my biggest thing was to make sure that I wrote every day. It didn't have to be a certain amount of time or a certain number of words, but just to keep the memories and the ideas fresh, I felt it was important to do some sort of writing every single day.
Did you have pretty much of an outline of threaded destiny in your mind, or even down on a page, that you kind of knew what was going to happen, or was this organic? Did this develop as you wrote?
It developed as I wrote to a certain extent, but there were definitely concrete ideas that I was working around. And it's interesting, once you start writing about a character, that character becomes very real to you, well, at least in my mind. And I started to kind of think, well, what would she do about this? How would she feel about this? And it sort of led me down some paths that I didn't fully expect. So the story, I pretty much knew the entire story, but I will say the ending took a little bit of a different turn than I initially thought I would use.
Could this ever be a motion picture?
Oh, absolutely. I think it would be wonderful as a TV series, because,
you know, they do a lot of these now in movies, a lot of the timeline stuff. And I'm not talking about the, you know, blow-em-up action stuff. That drives me nuts. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm talking about kind of, well, I like your term, light sci-fi.
Yes, light sci-fi, and with an appeal, I think, to everyone from 12 to 99.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fun book to kind of read through.
So it's okay for young adults? Nothing in there?
Absolutely. There's
be objectionable or anything like
nothing
that?
Nothing at all. No language. And the ideas are pretty rated G.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Threaded Destiny, the story of Alice wondering what really happened to her parents. She thought they died in a car crash? Or?
Yes, she thought they died in a car accident. But she never really knew the details, so she kind of, in the back of her mind, felt that something was up with all of that. And when she moved back to Harper, the town where she was originally from, things started to unfold for her.
Harper, Reed Butler.
Yes.
It's really Butler.
Yes.
Harper. Hey, it's nice to meet you. I knew it was going to be fun to chat. I knew from the minute we talked on the telephone while you were still in Florida. So.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Beth is going to be at the Book Nook. You know where the Book Nook is, right? It's right in the middle of downtown. It's North Main, but it's middle of downtown. Well, it's almost across the street from Cummings.
Yes,
not quite.
I was just about to add that. Yes, so. Very close.
What does Cummings become in your book?
Matter drinks. Matter, M-A-D-D-E-R, is actually the scientific name of the coffee bean plant.
You're just so clever. I can't believe this. Beth Brown will be at the Book Nook tomorrow from 11
to 1.
To 1. Mm-hmm. She'll be signing copies of her book if you'd like to pick one up.
And I would love to meet anybody who comes in. I'm looking forward to it.
And sale price on it tomorrow, too, by the way.
What's that?
Sale price on it tomorrow.
Yes,
right?
Sale price, $10.
Yeah. Nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You're going to be around long? You're headed back to Florida soon?
I'm headed back on Sunday. Have to get back to the real world of my jobs and everything else.
Well, enjoy your time here and Godspeed. Safe trip back home.
Thank you very much.
More to come on It's Your Turn. We take a break. David Talbot, we're going into the archives of It's Your Turn to find out about the CIA, the secret government of the U.S. In the news again with these JFK papers, right? Right? We'll talk with David Talbot right after these words. For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon. Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289.
I know of a way to reduce the level of future stress in your life, and I know that it works. One of the most distressful times in our lives is immediately after the death of a loved one, because we have to make so many decisions. The funeral, which casket, which minister, priest, or rabbi, cremation, visitations, church service or not, all these decisions. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler suggests that you avoid all these last-minute decisions during that most emotional time by pre-planning. To make all of these decisions now, when you can think clearly and rationally, when you're not burdened by the immediate event. Talk it over soon, now, with Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Call 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or www.thompson-miller.com. Pre-arrangement. It makes sense. Thompson Miller. Time-honored excellence.
Listeners, my name is Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn on WISR, we talk with author David Talbot about a book he's written and about a subject that has interested me for a long, long time. It's Alan Dulles and the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. The name of David Talbot's book is The Devil's Chessboard. First of all, David Talbot, welcome. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to chatting with you about your book.
My pleasure, Dave.
The full title, including the subtitle, listeners, is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. This has been a subject of interest for me for a long time, David. It's in the news, though, in recent years. You know, we've got Edward Snowden, we've got WikiLeaks, we've got other stuff. More and more people are thinking about this these days, are they not?
Yeah, there's nothing past about the past in this regard, that's for sure. Ed Snowden did, I think, bravely bring these issues before the American people in a very dramatic way. But look, torture, mass surveillance of private citizens, extraordinary renditions, CIA black sites, assassinations, these were all techniques that were developed not after 9/11, but they originated during the Dulles era. So it's long past time when the American people should be looking at this history, this dark history, and coming to terms with it.
a little bit about our guest listeners. David Talbot is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. He's written other books as well. He's also the founder and the former editor-in-chief of Salon. And we're talking to him today about his book, The Devil's Chessboard. I'd like to give a little bit of background for listeners who may not be up to speed on this, David Talbot, about, first of all, Alan Dulles, the prime subject of your book. He was the director of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, for about a decade, I believe, starting in the Eisenhower administration. Is my timeline correct on that?
That's correct, although his you know, career as a spy really begins before that. But yes, he finally takes over the CIA under Eisenhower and then into the first year of President Kennedy.
And he's not to be confused with his brother, and it's easy to confuse them because his brother was John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State for Eisenhower.
Yeah, they were a dynamic duo, the two brothers. And, of course, Dulles Airport is named after John Foster Dulles, the former Secretary of State. But they were young men born into a not a particularly wealthy family, but into a very well-connected family. Their grandfather was a Secretary of State. Their uncle was Secretary of State. They had international bankers and lawyers in the family. And so they were raised at the knee of power, and they were very accustomed to this world. And it was the world that C. Wright Mills, the famous sociologist in the 1950s, called the power elite. These are the men, the bankers, the statesmen, the national security officials, who feel that they run America no matter who happens to be in the White House at the time.
And Dulles, Alan Dulles, certainly manipulated numerous presidents. A wonderful introduction in your book, The Devil's Chessboard. You start with Alan Dulles crossing, this is during World War II, crossing the border from Vichy, France, into neutral Switzerland. It was November of 1942. We were right in the middle of World War II.
That's right. Well, you know, I like a good spy story as well as the next person, and I wanted to write this book in as gripping a way as I could. So it's kind of an anti-spy novel because most spy books, I think, carry kind of, an unpleasant ideology about them, which is that, you know, our intelligence agencies should be allowed to do whatever they want. But in any case, it is a dramatic story as Dulles slips across the border from Vichy, France, to Switzerland. But it's dramatic not in the way that Dulles wrote about it later. He wrote about it as if it was a great spy escapade. But in fact, it was almost as if he was expected by the Nazis as he crossed the border, which had been closed off by the Nazis. And, you know, Switzerland was neutral in those years. But in fact, it was a haven for Nazi interests. The Nazis were laundering their loot that they were expropriating from Europe in Swiss banks. It was a nest of intrigue there, and Alan Dulles quickly goes about doing business not to protect American interests so much as to protect his clients' interests. Mm. And his clients' interests go back to his days on Wall Street with his brother at the powerful firm Sullivan & Cromwell, and many of those clients included German and Nazi business interests, including the notorious IG Farben chemical company that manufactured Zyklon B, the horrendous pesticide that was used to exterminate, of course, millions of Jews in the concentration camps. And they're exchanging Christmas cards right up to the war with this fellow. In fact, Germany is already at war with the CEO of IG Farben. So there's Dulles in Switzerland, and it's, like I say, this Casablanca-like nest of intrigue. And he's meeting with Nazi officials and trying to cut a separate peace deal with them during the war. And in fact, he finally does with the Nazi forces in Italy in direct defiance of President Roosevelt's order. The Allies had declared a policy of unconditional surrender at the Casablanca Conference in 1943. They were going to crush, they said, the Nazi regime, not negotiate with them, and bring these men to justice. But instead, here's Dulles cutting his own deals with Hitler's representatives.
Listeners, this is so fascinating a read. It's a big book. I had to pinch myself several times to remember that this is all true. This is not a spy thriller. It certainly reads like that. Just to make sure we're in the right frame of reference here, David Talbot, Alan Dulles was not working for the there wasn't even a CIA during World War II. It was the predecessor of the CIA, the OSS, which was headed by William, I think his name was William Donovan. Yeah, Wild Bill Donovan. Was Talbot working for him, or was he in the army, or just under what pretense was he in Switzerland during this time?
Yeah, Dulles is working for Donovan. He's the top man, Donovan's top man, as I say, in continental Europe. Most spies were for the U.S. were based in London in those years. Mm-hmm. So he's off there on his own, and he has quite a bit of license to do whatever he wants. And one of the things he does near the end of the war is set up these so-called Nazi rat lines, which were these escape routes that allowed many Nazi war criminals to escape down through the Alps into Italy and then overseas. He even rehabilitates Hitler's top spymaster, a fellow named Reinhard Gehlen. He was Hitler's spymaster on the Eastern Front, and Dulles helps install him in power after the war as the top spymaster in democratic West Germany. He brings him to the U.S., he wines him and dines him, he takes him to his club, he gets some tickets to the 1951 World Series where Joe DiMaggio played his last game. So this was a kind of cozy collaboration that Dulles set up between U.S. intelligence and the kind of poisoned remnants of Hitler's regime. You know, the American people don't know the full extent of this terrible collaboration during the Cold War. And it was done in the name of security because Dulles and his crowd felt that the Soviet Union, who actually paid the most bitter price during World War II in their battle with Hitler, losing over 20 million people, but he felt that the Soviet Union was the true enemy and not Hitler's Germany.
There's much more about the World War II machinations, listeners of Alan Dulles, in David Talbot's book, The Devil's Chessboard. We need to take a break. I want to talk in the time that we have remaining about, I think, what's the really shocking part of it. And this is shocking. Evidence that perhaps pits Dulles at the center of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We'll talk about that in a minute. Our guest is David Talbot with us on It's Your Turn here on WISR. We'll pick up our conversation with him right after these words. You know, sometimes you hear about a business celebrating an anniversary. 20th, 25th, 30th. It's great, you know. 50th. Miller Shoes, folks, is celebrating their 125th anniversary. 125 years in business. Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. You'll find some great buys there, whether you're looking for athletic shoes. They have all the famous name brands. They're right there under one roof. You don't have to go to three or four different stores. They've got Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, ASICS, ProPet, all there. They have name brand shoes and boots that you know are going to last. Names like Timberland, shoes and boots. By the way, you know, I hate to bring this up, but bad weather is just around the corner. How about a new pair of Timberland boots for the winter? Mm-hmm. Or Rockport, there's another really good shoe. And always lots of pairs of men's and women's shoes on racks, sale priced for easy browsing. Oh, and they are also your local headquarters for America's favorite comfort shoes, American-made SAS shoes. You'll find them at Miller's, and you'll find a great price right now. And by the way, make sure and wish them happy anniversary when you stop in. 125 years in business. Miller's Shoes, a Butler tradition for generations. 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Miller's.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 5454. Pick three is 996. 996. Pick four, 5514. Pick five, 88748. Wild ball for each of those is six. The treasure hunt is 4, 14, 21, 24, and 25. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. Ever have a tough time getting the motor started early in the morning? I know what you mean. Well, maybe I can help. I'd like to invite you to join me every weekday morning, Monday through Friday, for the Early Morning Show here on WISR. We start with the first local news of the day, bright and early at 5:30. We go to 9:30, and oh yes, we pause for half an hour and have coffee with Kate at 8:30 every weekday morning, too. Please join me. I'd like to share the early morning hours, 5:30 weekdays here on WISR. Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Our special guest visits with us by telephone. He is author David Talbot. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We left Alan Dulles working for the OSS. The CIA came into being after World War II. Truman was president by then. Roosevelt had died. This was in the late 40s. Did Dulles make a natural transition into the CIA? Is that what set him up to be appointed the head of the CIA by Eisenhower, David?
Yeah, even though he ostensibly goes back to business, working on Wall Street after World War II, he really never leaves the intelligence world. And he's key to organizing the CIA and getting that pushed through Congress and signed into law by President Truman. So he's always active, no matter who's president, in the kind of shadows of American politics. And then he formally becomes CIA director under Eisenhower in 1953.
Now, when John F. Kennedy is elected president in 1960, he keeps Alan Dulles on as head of the CIA. He could have replaced him, I'm sure, if he wanted to.
Yeah, well, Kennedy's new frontiersmen, the young advisors around him, were very intent on having Kennedy replace this old regime and get rid of people like Alan Dulles at the CIA, like J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. But he holds on to some of these men from the Eisenhower presidency to show a kind of continuity of power. He'd won by a very thin margin, and I think advisors like his father, old Joe Kennedy, thought it was important for this young new president to show the country that he was going to be someone they could trust. Unfortunately, he keeps three key figures, the two I mentioned, Hoover at FBI and Dulles at the CIA, and then a fellow named C. Douglas Dillon, who was a Republican Wall Street banker who had worked for Eisenhower in the State Department, rather. And he appoints Dillon, this is JFK, head of the Treasury Department. Well, as you know, the Treasury Department oversees the Secret Service. So in other words, the three key security agencies in Washington, the CIA and the FBI and the Secret Service, are all in the hands of political enemies of President Kennedy from the very beginning.
And then, of course, comes the disaster of the Bay of Pigs. I believe the date was 1961. It was early in Kennedy's presidency. And Kennedy, I'm truncating here, but Kennedy canned Alan Dulles after the Bay of Pigs, right?
That's right. He was furious that the invasion, which he never wanted, quickly went south. Kennedy felt he was being sandbagged by the CIA into expanding that invasion, and instead of just using this motley brigade of Cuban exiles, bringing in the full power of the U.S. Marines and Air Force. Kennedy refused to be pushed into that by the CIA, and he later is so furious, he famously says he wants to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. Well, what he does do is fire Dulles and his two top deputies. But Dulles doesn't get the memo. Again, in defiance of the president, which is the pattern of someone like Dulles, he goes home to Georgetown in Washington and proceeds to operate as if he's still running the CIA. He's meeting with his top deputies. And by the way, this all comes from his own day books, his calendars that I saw with his documents that are kept at Princeton University. He's acting to subvert the Kennedy presidency. He basically sets up an anti-Kennedy government in exile. Among the people he's meeting with, and this is where it starts to get alarming, are men who are later figures of suspicion in the 1970s congressional investigation that reopened the Kennedy case and came to the conclusion, in contradiction of the Warren Report, that indeed there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. So here's Alan Dulles, supposedly retired after being forced out of power by Kennedy, meeting with these suspicious characters who were later tied to the Kennedy assassination.
Wow. Well, even there, David Talbot, it's a step, big step to put Dulles in the center of the assassination. But did you discover new evidence in the course of your research of this book, The Devil's Chessboard? I know some of the things that I was hitting on when I was briefing the review copy of your book, which unfortunately just arrived a couple of days ago, so I haven't been able to read it all. But there were some people who showed up in Dallas right at the time of Kennedy's assassination, who had some connections with the plot to assassinate Castro and the whole Bay of Pigs thing.
That's right. And by the way, you know, Dave, I'm building on the work, 50 years of work by very reputable researchers, including in your area in Pittsburgh, the great Cyril Wecht, the pathologist at Duquesne University, who runs the Wecht Institute with his son, Ben. And so there have been dozens of people who've really paved the way for the American people, because the U.S. government, by and large, except for the House Committee in the 70s, and the media have really let the American people down and not done the investigation they should. So you say, yes, there's a bit of a leap to implicate Dulles in this, but it's not a huge leap. And here's some of the reasons. As you mentioned, not only was Dulles operating as if he was still running the CIA at Georgetown, continued to hate Kennedy and subvert his policies any way he could, but the kill team, the assassination team that he'd put together to work with the mafia to assassinate Fidel Castro, all of which came out during the 1970s and the Church Committee hearings, that guy, William Harvey, who also hated the Kennedys and had a terrible falling out with them around Cuba, he spotted by his own deputy flying from Rome, where he was stationed at the time, to Dallas in November 1963, right before the assassination. And when his deputy asked William Harvey, "Why are you going to Dallas?" he was very evasive. "I'm going there just to look around," he said. Well, his deputy, a man named Mark Wyatt, who served honorably with the CIA for many years, later told his grown children that he was convinced, based on evidence from working with Harvey in Rome, that Bill Harvey was indeed involved in Kennedy's assassination. This is Dulles's top hitman. So where was Dulles on the weekend of November 22nd, 1963, while the president's killed and then Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin, is himself conveniently killed? Well, he's not at home watching these terrible events in front of the TV as a retired gentleman, which he supposedly was. He was at a remote CIA facility in Northern Virginia known as the Farm that he'd set up as an alternate command post when he was director of the CIA. That's never been explained why he spent that entire weekend there. So no smoking guns, perhaps, but a wealth of circumstantial evidence that does suggest Alan Dulles was involved in the planning of this terrible crime. And it's indisputable that he was centrally involved in the cover-up, because he finagles his way onto the Warren Commission after the assassination, where he quickly becomes a dominant figure and basically helps run that investigation into the death of the man who is his mortal political enemy.
Almost unbelievable. Folks, this is a really good read. It's a page-turner. It really is. And there are pictures, and not just a couple. Pictures of some of the German generals. I've never seen this picture of Goering at the Nuremberg War Trials. And there's also a photograph of an autopsy photograph of JFK that I've never seen before. Wow.
Well, that's an important autopsy photo, because, of course, the surgeons who worked on the dying president at Parkland Hospital in Dallas later testified, later wrote books to this effect, and were interviewed late in their life, that they saw physical evidence that the president was shot from the front and the back, that the throat wounds were entry wounds, indicating he was shot from the direction of the infamous grassy knoll, and of course there was evidence he was shot from behind as well. Well, of course, that's on the face of it evidence of a conspiracy.
By the way, the aforementioned Dr. Cyril Wecht, David, has been a guest on this program. We've had some fascinating conversations with him, as you might well imagine.
I have great, great respect for Cyril and for the work he's done over these years. We couldn't have really advanced this case without the work of people like Dr. Wecht.
I have tons more questions, but I don't have any more time. Listeners, again, this is a great read. The title of the book is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, by best-selling author David Talbot, who has been our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn. David Talbot, nice to meet you. Terrific to talk with you today.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, I want to tell you, am I ever glad that we dug that out of the It's Your Turn archives. That's an interview that I did with David Talbot, I want to say maybe a year and a half ago. I had forgotten that we talked about the assassination of JF Kennedy. So there's a definite tie-in with the news of this week and how the CIA persuaded President Trump to withhold 200 of the files instead of releasing them yesterday. Wow. Wow. Hmm. Okay, that wraps up our program today. Thanks, by the way, to Beth Brown, a delightful guest, joining us earlier on the program today. She's back in Butler from her home in Florida. She's a graduate of Butler High School. She's back for a book signing appearance at the Book Nook tomorrow from 11 to 1, signing copies of her novel, Threaded Destiny. On the Monday program, we'll talk with Matthew Kramer, director of the Butler Symphony, another concert coming up. We will begin